The Way Out Podcast, episode 118.
The wound is deep. The grief is deep. And it is in a lot of us, and it's not always the same grief. But I tell you what about grief, it's deep. And it's like having an open cut. And if you go around with the open cut, that blood is going to get on the people in your life. It's going to get on the walls at your job. It's going to get in your car, you know. And so often we settle, right? We're just like, just give me a Band-Aid, and we put a Band-Aid on it, right? And that might be alcohol for you, that might be food for you, that might be work for you, that might be whatever for you, right? And then we think we're okay, and somebody offers us some Neosporin to put on that cut, and we're trying to rub it in on top of the Band-Aid, and it doesn't work that way.
Welcome. Thank you for joining us on this week's installment of The Way Out, sharing stories from people just like you who have recovered from alcoholism and other addictions. The Way Out does not speak on behalf of, nor are we affiliated with any 12-step organization. Our purpose is to share with you, one episode at a time, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. The Way Out Podcast is sponsored by Transitions Daily. Would you like to join a free, anonymous, online group that offers a daily topic email with popular recovery resources accompanied by a secret Facebook group for discussion? Go to dailyaaemails.com for more information about Transitions Daily. Don't forget to share dailyaaemails.com with friends, in meetings, and with sponsees in recovery. Make sure to check out the official website of The Way Out Podcast at www.wayoutcast.com. There you will find links to our latest episodes on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and Radio FM. You can also follow The Way Out Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Help us get the message out that lifelong recovery from alcoholism and addiction is possible by giving us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform.
Have a question or comment about an upcoming or previous show? Call us right now. Area code 218-382-1960. Call us anytime, day or night, and leave us a message on whatever is on your mind. Maybe it's a previous episode topic or something that you're struggling with in your own recovery. Call us at 218-382-1960 and leave The Way Out Podcast hosts a message, and we could feature it on our next episode. That's 218-382-1960. Help us recover out loud.
Last but certainly not least, make sure to check out altrecoveryrigs.com for stunning rings made from your very own recovery coin. That's altrecoveryrigs.com. The Way Out Podcast is on right now. I'm Charlie, and this week we've got a downright remarkable story to share with you. A story not often heard on The Way Out Podcast airwaves. Melinda's story is marked by a tumultuous and chaotic childhood, providing the fertile soil for dysfunction and addiction to take root as she began to traverse the uncharted territory of adulthood. The sentinel moment that marked the beginning of Melinda's recovery is ultra relatable and provides the compelling catalyst for her finding recovery in various programs, not the least of which included the 12 steps in adult children of alcoholics. Melinda's perspective on recovery is on point, astute, and nuanced, and quite refreshing. To that end, and without further ado, I give you Melinda in unadulterated and totally uninterrupted fashion. Listen up. Melinda, welcome to The Way Out Podcast. I can't thank you enough for now coming down into The Way Out Podcast studios twice. We had a bit of a malfunction the first time we attempted to do this in-person interview, so I appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to come down and to share your experience, strength, and hope with us in The Way Out Podcast audience. If you could take some time to introduce yourself to The Way Out Podcast audience, tell us a little bit about who you are, what's your sobriety date, and a little bit about what you do, and then we'll dig into your story a little bit. How's that sound?
All right. Absolutely. My name is Melinda, and I'm a woman in long-term recovery. My path began in a family that was riddled with addiction and dysfunction. My dad was an alcoholic. My mom had undiagnosed mental health issues, specifically hoarding. I was raised to don't talk, don't trust, don't feel was the family motto, and that carried through much of my adolescence and my adulthood, constantly mired in shame, kind of reflective of where I came from. I never believed I was good enough. I never believed I was a woman enough. I never believed I was a friend enough, a chef enough, an employee enough, whatever it was, you put in a blank and I wasn't enough of it. And it came out. I got a lot out of my life. I'm really glad for my life up to this point. I got to travel a lot. I got to meet a lot of amazing chefs and a lot of amazing people, both here and abroad. And it's been great until around 2015, which is when I walked into the Rooms of Recovery for the first time on June 15th of 2015. My first step was into an Al-Anon group. And for all the old timers who are probably going to listen to this, who've heard this story before, you know, Al-Anoners, you know, come thinking that they're there to address somebody else's abuse. And they find out that, yeah, this is a program about them, not the person they think they're there
they're
for.
Trying to fix.
Right. And right away, you know, it didn't make any sense to me. I walked into that room an atheist. It was a Sunday, Father's Day, 2015, to be specific. And I just had had a night in the restaurant the night before. My sous chef had been railing up and down the line cook, who was working about 11 inches away from me. And I mean, I could feel my sous chef's breath. I could smell my sous chef's breath just tearing this guy up. You know, what are you, retarded? And did you cook this? Does this look like medium rare to you? If it does, you're either stupid or blind, and I don't want you working in my restaurant. And the guy standing next to me, he was turning beet red. And to put some context on this, this was a guy who was an Iraqi war vet who had spent his college fund going to culinary school because he thought, you know, well, cooking looks easy. And he was beet red and he was starting to cry. And I thought to myself, you know, this isn't right. This isn't right. You know, this was number 1,000 of thousands of nights just like this. But this night, something broke inside me. You know, I recognized that as an adult child of an alcoholic, you know, you don't get in the line of fire between the powerful and the weak when the powerful are pissed, because then, you know, you're subject to the same abuse. So I just kept my nose down and I just kept my mouth shut. And at the end of that shift, you know, I downed who knows how many glasses of tequila and walked out into the streets, and I watched my Latino dishwashers getting on the bus, going to probably their second or third job of the night. And I remember thinking to myself, well, the only way I'm going to stop this pattern, the only way I'm going to change anything is maybe if I jump in front of that bus. And, you know, of course, I backed it up a bit because I realized, you know, if you've ever worked in the restaurant industry, unless I really died, they were going to find a way to make me come back to work on Monday, you know, prop me up on a stool, you know, put me in a sling, who knows. But I remember thinking, I got to do something. You know, I don't want to leave work every night, you know, like this, wanting to not wake up the next day, you know, not coming back to the same day over and over and over again. And so the next day, Father's Day, I walked into the rooms of Al-Anon, and I liked what I saw. I mean, there was people there sharing about some deep, dark stuff that I was like, you guys are talking about this and you're not drunk, like you're sober and you're sharing this stuff. And I said, okay, I'll give this a try. And I didn't do it steadily. I did it like maybe once or twice, maybe three times. And, you know, the God stuff scared me away. I was just like, because I was an atheist at the time. And I was just like, oh, yeah, the God stuff. But, well, as higher power would have it, about 2 months later, I started dating an active alcoholic who was active in the AA program. And as support, once again, for him, not at all for me, of course, I started going to meetings with him to support his attendance at them. And I liked what AA had to offer. Al-Anon makes sense. AA makes sense. The 12 steps just make sense. And so I started pursuing that a little bit further. And then my boyfriend's sponsor at the time, though he couldn't sponsor me because of the gender difference, started kind of pointing me towards some spiritual texts and pages in the big book to follow, and I started doing that. And then the next year, I moved up here to Minnesota. I was living in Madison, Wisconsin at the time. I moved up here to Minnesota and found that this was the recovery capital of the world.
Literally the recovery capital of the world. You are not, you're not lying about that.
Yep, no joke. January 2016, I walked into the rooms of Refuge Recovery for the first time. Had never meditated before, but I heard some good things about it, and I heard that there was no mention of God. So I started to work Refuge Recovery once or twice a week, and I'd do Al-Anon once a week, and I'd go to an AA meeting. I was basically assigned myself the 90 and 90 without having a sponsor to assign it to me. And then on March 1st of 2016, I walked into the rooms of Adult Children of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my life hasn't been the same since.
I want to stop you right there, because the when we start taking this journey, your journey began many, 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 many years ago, but in earnest, in regard to starting to do the work in order to get well, you started to take some action based on not wanting to ever feel the way you felt ever again. Walking out of that restaurant that night and never wanting to feel powerless. That way again.
I never want to feel that powerless. I never want to feel that small. I never recognized how small I was allowing myself to feel by engaging in that kind of environment where I, in essence, was recreating my childhood in every restaurant I worked in my entire life without really acknowledging that.
This toxic environment.
Absolutely.
That you were raised in and conditioned to repeat in adulthood. You had found yourself in those toxic environments over and over.
Absolutely. I mean, if you go behind the swinging doors of any restaurant in the country, you'll find every vice, every addiction, every dysfunction, whether it be anger as an addiction, or whether it be sexual harassment, whether it be heroin, cocaine, energy drinks, caffeine, you know, just general unmanageability. Even the sober people, which there aren't many, but even the sober people in restaurants have a certain kind of sober unmanageability about them. And in ACA, Adult Children of Alcoholics, we talk mostly about emotional sobriety, the emotional intoxicants of anger, of shame, of procrastination, of, you know, you name it, all the character defects.
And we're going to talk a lot more about emotional sobriety in this interview, because a guy you and I both know, Bill W., many years ago, dubbed emotional sobriety as the next frontier of Alcoholics Anonymous. He never got around to that. He passed before that really took root in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I really do believe in my core that emotional sobriety is the real goal.
Absolutely.
Physical sobriety is important and necessary in order for me to be able to begin that journey of emotional sobriety.
Yep.
But emotional sobriety in spiritual fitness are primary goals in sobriety for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when we're talking about, I like that you used the word spiritual fitness. I like to use the word spiritual wellness because, you know, just that word fit's kind of a trigger button for me because I never felt like I fit anywhere. So it's like, what does fitness mean, right?
Right.
Does it mean I fit in-ness?
Right.
Yeah. But spiritual wellness, yeah, I think that's what all of the greatest faith-based societies are aimed at. whether we're talking about Christianity or Buddhism or Judaism or Islam, you name it. It's all about being spiritually well with whatever is being presented to you at any given moment.
You identify as an adult child of an alcoholic.
Yes.
You identify as an alcoholic.
Yes.
And you also identify with codependence?
Yes.
Tell me what it's like, and tell our audience what it's like to have had to battle both of those while they were active. I know what it's like to battle alcoholism and addiction. I do not know what it's like to also battle the disease around being an adult child of an alcoholic and also deal with the codependence that surrounds that.
Sure. Well, I mean, codependency is, in my opinion, probably one of the most dangerous diseases that there are out there. And if anybody is listening has ever seen the film Pleasure Unwoven, which they love to show at treatment centers in the Twin Cities, and elsewhere probably too, you'll probably recognize a scene in the film where they show the periodic table of substances, and they have them clustered into hallucinogens and stimulants and narcotic different varieties and stuff. And then on the bottom, they've got food, sex, codependency, and gambling, because those are recognized as triggering chemicals within us, dopamine and serotonin, all that stuff. And you really can relapse on codependency the way that, for instance, somebody who has quit using alcohol decides to pick up marijuana. It really, and then, of course, we all know where that ends.
You the cross-addiction piece.
That cross-addiction piece, yeah. The codependency to me is like being in one of those driver's ed cars where you think you're in control of the wheel, but somebody else has a set of the brakes and they can jam them on at any time they want, and they can steer the car to the right while you're trying to steer to the left. And it's this constant state of being a co-pilot in your own life. Codependency, you know, from what I've seen, has led more men and women back to their substance of choice than any other thing, including their work, including toxic family situations, including medical abbreviations or interruptions in their physical wellness. You hear it all the time. I was doing really well. I had 6 months, I had 9 months, I had a year. And then I met this guy. Or, oh, I had mm-hmm. 6 months, 9 months, and then I met this chick, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's something to be absolutely vigilant about.
What did codependency look like for you before you entered recovery?
Codependency to me before I entered recovery. So if you had met me on June 1st of 2015 and you said, hey, you know, my name's Charles, what's your name? I'd have been like, never mind my name, I'm a chef. Basically, codependency to me looked like I was defined by anything but my value as a human being. I was valued by what I did for others. I was valued by how I produced or performed at work. I was valued, my value derived from whether or not my significant other was happy in the relationship. Mm. I was defined by a lot of my resentment. I had codependency on my resentments to my family upbringing.
Mm. What you attached your identity to.
Right. Which is, you know, I really appreciate, you know, in some of the recovery circles that I run in, you know, when you ask somebody how they're doing, you know, they're, oh, blessed and highly favored, or how are you doing today, or what's your story? Well, when they begin with, oh, I'm a child of God, I'm like, I want to know more, you know, mm-hmm. tell me more, you know, because mm-hmm. it sounds like you've shed that mortal coil of, you know, what else holds us here.
What we often attach our identity to. Something you said that I think is really instructive in terms of what codependency looked like for you was assigning your value and essentially handing over the keys to your value to other people.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's stages of dependency in anybody's life, right? You come in, to the world, you're completely dependent on another human being. If you have any doubts about that, if you have a belly button, you were completely dependent upon somebody else when you came into this world, right?
Right.
You need to be codependent when you're 7 to 14 because you're asking questions like, hey, can I jump off this roof with a sheet tied to my back? And your mom's like, no, she's got to put the brakes on. You're driving the bus, but she's got to put the brakes on. And then you get into your late adolescence, you know, 16 to 30 or so, and you're really trying really hard to establish your independence, right? Like, I can do this, you know, and you probably can. You're physically capable, usually. You may be financially capable. You may be intellectually capable of doing a lot of things on your own. And then we're meant to develop into interdependence when we begin to become part of something greater than ourselves, our families, you know, with our spouses, our children, our ancestors, our, you know, whether they're alive or not, you know, just the people that we've come from and the people who are going to come from us. We find ourselves interdependent upon things, able, a healthy person, able to accept, ask for and accept help from others, right? But drugs and alcohol put the brakes on that. Whatever stage, and this is not an uncommon belief, whatever stage alcohol and drugs or whatever other addiction entered your life is the stage of dependency in which you got stuck.
That arrested development.
Yeah. So if drugs and alcohol entered you when you were in the codependent stage, which it usually does, somewhere between 7 and 16.
In adolescence,
you're going to be still in that path of codependency.
Or if you grew up in an environment that was toxic,
right,
from a family perspective, could also perpetuate that state of dependence.
Absolutely. So if you were born into a system where there was alcoholism or drug addiction already, you may become the person that we would call having learned helplessness. Or vice versa, if alcohol entered your life late in adolescence, you might be stuck in your independent stage, that I don't need anybody.
The defiance stage,
the isolationist, you know, the one who is like, I don't need anybody's help. I hate meetings, right? The learned helplessness person loves meetings, right? Because
right.
They get what they're looking for. They get what their 4-year-old self was looking for. The codependent doesn't want to go to meetings and doesn't want to be alone. They want to attach to one other thing, a job, a partner, a child, right? Because parents are hugely codependent on their children. And you find a lot of parents in the rooms of Codependents Anonymous addressing their relationships with their now adult children. And then, yeah, the late stage codependence.
Tell me what it was like to enter these rooms of recovery and learn more about, how did you learn about recovery? It sounds like you had started to dabble in Al-Anon before you had, you know, had somebody in your life that was in recovery.
Right.
How did you learn about it? What brought you into a room, a 12-step meeting?
You know, I don't remember. It's got to be a higher power thing. I remember the song that was playing on my way to the first Al-Anon meeting I ever attended. I remember the street I was driving. I remember where the sun was in the sky. I can't remember what brought me to the Serenity Club in Fitchburg, Wisconsin. I just went. Like I said, it was Sunday. I knew therapists don't work on Sunday. That night before, I'd really scared myself with the thoughts I had about jumping in front of that bus. And I said, I got to do something. And I think maybe I looked up in the newspaper in Madison. They have a newspaper called the Isthmus or something like that. And maybe there was some support group listings in the back page of the newspaper.
Bottom line is that you got to a point where you could no longer live the way you were living.
Absolutely. I couldn't. Didn't want to.
And you reached out.
Yeah. I walked, you know, it's funny because people often say, you know, you can't drag somebody kicking and screaming to an AA meeting, right? It doesn't work like that. I had to find it on my own. And I found ACA on my own. You know, I sought out Refuge Recovery, like when I wasn't sure if Al-Anon was going to be the thing for me, you know. I also looked at Workaholics Anonymous.
Tell me about Refuge Recovery and your experience with Refuge Recovery, and perhaps for people listening that aren't aware of Refuge, how, you know, the parallels and maybe some differences between Alcoholics Anonymous.
Sure. Well, Refuge Recovery is kind of a Buddhist approach to recovery. Instead of the 12 steps, we have the Eightfold Path. you know, instead of
the eightfold path.
The eightfold
cool.
path. Yeah.
Like it.
And it speaks to that addiction creates suffering. That all of life is suffering, and we are often drawn to addictions based on either our grasping for things that we want or our aversion of things that we don't want in our lives at any given time. That sort of restless, irritable, and discontentment that you'd have if you were reading the big book, right? The Eightfold Path is a path to, I guess, what you'd call right living, where it talks about a livelihood that hurts no one or minimizes the effects that you have on the world. Right thought, which of course leads to right speech, which of course leads to right action. It talks about not indulging in intoxicants so that we can maintain mindful awareness at all times, mindful of the present moment. And so the parallels aren't very disguised there between that and the 12-step program. Buddhism and Christianity, more similar than different.
No
Buddhism,
doubt.
Of course, not being a religion at all, but being a practice. You can be a practice. You can practice Buddhism while being a Christian. There's, you know, if you have an understanding of those two things, then you're in a good spot. But, you know, you've got the Ten Commandments. You've got the Eightfold Path.
Tell me about the process for you as you worked through that Eightfold Path and the change it produced in you.
Well, if it weren't for Refuge Recovery, I don't think I would have embraced the 12 steps as much as I did. Like I said, when I first went into the 12 step rooms, there's also Buddhism and 12 step meetings here in the Twin Cities. Some people call them B12 meetings. And because Buddhism and the big book, all the kind of teachings of how to live a healthy, happy life are so similar to one another. I remember sitting in a Buddhism and 12-step meeting at Common Grounds Meditation Center one night, and this guy was sitting next to me. And, you know, in our small groups, we broke up into small groups, and I was telling him how hard it was for me to say the God stuff at AA meetings. And he's just like, well, you know, for me, you know, thanks to Buddhism, I've kind of changed the God word to an acronym, and we all know some of the common acronyms for AA for God, like good orderly drunks and good orderly direction or good old whatever. But he had said grateful, open, and detached. He said, if until you can say God, act as if, you know, and stick with this, and it worked for me. But it was that kind of like loosening of that noose of certainty that I had to either be all right or all wrong about the God I had in my imagination at the time. Buddhism allowed me to kind of loosen that noose and let some other thoughts in. And then once I did, I found Christianity not so prickly anymore.
I love the way that you explain your spiritual journey in that you loosened your grip on certainty.
Yeah.
Which is perhaps the most spiritual thing we can do.
Yeah.
Is accept perhaps we don't know. And maybe that's okay.
Not knowing today is one of my greatest comforts.
To embrace the uncertainty, the unknown, yet still have a faith that this power greater than ourselves, whatever that might be, can help.
What's funny about my faith journey is that when I came into the rooms of anything, you name it, whatever room I've walked into in the past 3 years, because I've walked into a lot of them. If you had told me that a fox with its tail on fire is how the sun sets and rises, I'd have had no question about that. If you'd have told me that a single day of oil lasted 8 days, like in the Jewish faith for Hanukkah, I'd have had no problems with that. But as soon as you uttered anything about Jesus Christ, I'd have shut you right down and walked away. My mental doors would have just clocked, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I had to look at that and realize, why and how did I come to start to paint this ugly face on Jesus Christ? And only Jesus Christ.
Mm.
I had no other problem with any other faith stories, origin stories, holidays, anything else like that. It was just this. And I had to recognize the fact that there's a good chance, and we talk about this in ACA, that I had either painted my critical parent, my dysfunctional parent, my abusive parent's face on God, or that through this sort of black and white religiosity that I had grown up in, I had tied that noose of certainty around my neck that God was not for me. He was only against me.
I relate to that in such an intimate way. And as I've said many times on this podcast, I equated God with the entity responsible for taking my mother from me when I was 11 years old. And I made a very fateful decision that I didn't need a God like that in my life. Mm. That God could actually go fuck himself if he saw fit to take my mother away from me at that age. And the amount of anger and the amount of rage and the amount of resentment that I carried toward this God, this idea of God that I had in my mind that took away my mother from me, really poured kerosene on an already very, very, very tinder box of a life that I had for alcoholism and addiction, right? Because I didn't have, not only was there a vacuum there then that I filled with drugs and alcohol and sex and relationships and whatever I could fit in there temporarily to fill that void, to fill that vacuum, that spiritual vacuum that I created. When I got into recovery this time, the third time around in my life that I had been faced with an opportunity to recover, I ran an experiment. That was it. I simply ran an experiment. If it wasn't for Joe and Charlie.
Oh, I love Joe and Charlie. Love Joe and Charlie.
Preeminently responsible for allowing me to do the actions, motivating me to do the actions that I needed to do in order for some of this stuff to start to work inside of me. And then thereby lighting the recovery fire inside of me.
Right.
I just ran the experiment. And Joe and Charlie kept saying, you know what? If it doesn't work at the end, you can have your old life back. You can have it back. We promise. Just do this. Don't ask any questions. You don't have to know what God is. You don't have to have a definition of God. You have to know nothing about it. All you have to do is the next thing. And just keep doing the next thing. And don't think about it. And if somebody says pray, just pray. I don't care who you're praying to. I don't care if you don't have an idea of what it is. It doesn't matter. So I legitimately started praying to a God that I had no concept of. None. Zero. I wiped it all away. All of it. And over time, and it wasn't that much time, but over time, it was producing a change in me. A God that I had no concept of, that I didn't understand, was producing a very real change in me, in my attitudes, in my thoughts, in my behaviors, in how I felt about myself and about others. And if that isn't the manifestation of a true spiritual experience, I don't know what is.
Well, to our listening audience, I guess you can't see Charles right now, but man, his story when he was talking about having lost his mother, the wound is deep, the grief is deep, and it is in a lot of us, and it's not always the same grief, but I tell you what about grief, it's deep, and it's like having an open cut, and if you go around with the open cut, that blood is going to get on the people in your life, it's going to get on the walls at your job, it's going to get in your car, you know, and so often we we settle, right? We're just like, just give me a Band-Aid, and we put a Band-Aid on it, right? And that might be alcohol for you. That might be food for you. That might be work for you. That might be whatever for you, right? And then we think we're okay, and somebody offers us some Neosporin to put on that cut, and we're trying to rub it in on top of the Band-Aid, and it doesn't work that way. You got to take the Band-Aid off, put the Neosporin on there, and that Neosporin looks like whatever, right? That might look like faith. That might look like fellowship. That might look like therapy. That might look like exercise. That might look like yoga. That might look like a pet, right? I have friends out there right now who the only thing keeping them alive right now is their pets. They think, if I don't make it home from work tonight, they need me, you know? And that's how God's shown up in their life. God has four legs that day. So what, you know? But I think that piece about looking at where is the grief, where is that, and how can we start to let it heal? What's going to be the balm for that? Because it's not always the same medication for everybody. And I think that's, you know, sometimes you walk into these rooms and they think, you know, people think, oh, well, your God has white long hair and a staff, as Joe and Charlie say in their explanation about how he came to come up with a God of his own understanding. That
right.
Yeah, how in the South, if he were to say what his, you know, what his God looked like, he'd be kicked right out of church, that kind of thing. It's so funny, the assumptions that people make, because you could walk into any church in this city on any Sunday, and you're still not praying to the same God as the person standing next to you. You could be reading the same book and singing the same song and listening to the same pastor, and your God is still not the same as the person sitting next to you. And it's not the same as your kids, and it's not the same as your husbands, and it's not the same as your... So why would we then, in AA, try to say everybody's God's got to look like the white guy with the staff in the sky and the cloud and the pointy finger stuff? You know, it's just not the case.
A good friend of mine is fond of saying, and I love this because it's the way it worked for me, you know, when I looked at step two and I looked at step three, and I thought the idea that I need to create a God that somehow is going to provide me this power to recover is about the most absurd thing I have ever heard in my entire life. If I can create it, it's not big enough for me. And that's, he says it all the time. If I can think it, if I can create it, if I can imagine it, it's not big enough. And that to me is the essence of my relationship with my higher power. I can't create it. I can't conceptualize it. I get small, sort of like, I think you did such a wonderful job illustrating how God shows up. I can see it and I can feel it. And it's sort of like porn. You know it when you see it? God's the same way.
Oh, yeah.
I know God when I see God. And I see God in meetings. I see God in my life. I see God in my pets. I see God in my children. And I see God in myself every now and again today.
That's beautiful.
I know it when I see it.
And you see it because you're looking for it now, and you weren't before, maybe?
Because I'm open to it. I'm receptive to it. That channel's been opened. And it closes sometimes still. And I get blocked still.
Sure.
And it's noisy out there, Melinda. It's noisy. And that noise, the din of life, often allows me to drown out and block off the God of my understanding. And it is an intentional act for me to remain unblocked. Absolutely. So then I can see.
Yeah, intentional living is difficult. It's less difficult when we have other people who are intentionally living alongside of us. And that, you know, when we first come into the rooms, you know, if we're given the ability, if we're told it's okay to think of the fellowship as our higher power at first, then I think that you're in the right rooms, right? When you're told, well, you can't just use the meetings as your higher power, you know, people get discouraged, they leave, and they're just like, oh, so my higher power has to look like it. well, you know, so you find a different meeting.
That's right.
But you intentionally seek out one where you're like, this is my tribe. And you can, yeah, there are so many meetings, especially in the Twin Cities. We're so blessed here. You can walk into any meeting and find a different vibe. But like you said, you go where you find God.
I've been told that the only thing really that it takes to start a new meeting is a resentment and a coffee pot. And the coffee pot is optional, right? So it appears that that's happened a time or two in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I agree that you find one that speaks to you.
Yeah.
And if it stops speaking to you, you know, I got to do some self work, and I got to make sure that it's not me, and that there's not something inside of me that's not that is contributing to that. Because often I am guilty of thinking that something else has changed my job, my relationship, my children, and they're no longer serving me. I'm no longer satisfied with them. Mm-hmm. But really, the only thing that's changed is me.
Sure. You're all there is, really. You know, some people would say everything you see is a projection of what's going on inside you anyway, right? So if there's something, you know, page 417, right? If you see something that's outside you, that's not how you want it to be, you better look inside, right? And that's, again, why I think that the meditation practice and the 12 steps work so well together. You know, if you take a minute when you're feeling uncomfortable, when you feel that tension in your body, if you're living in the present moment and you feel that tension start to come up, you can say, oh, what am I feeling right now? Where am I holding this? Where have I felt this before? And that goes to your bringing up the resentment thing is, yeah, it is resentiment. It's about re-feeling.
I'm re-feeling this.
Yeah. And it's not even, oh, I've been here before with this person. It's, I've been here before with some person. And how am I projecting that person onto the person I'm sitting with right now? You know, oh, that's right. If I can stop my thinking, I can recognize, oh, my partner isn't actually my mom. You know, the buttons that my partner is pushing in me are the same buttons my mom pushed, but I don't have to react to my partner the same way I reacted with my mom when I was 16 or 20 or 10.
I don't have to think the way I feel.
I don't have to think the way I feel, yeah.
Tell me about the process of working through the 12 steps, and what was that like for you?
I love my sponsor. I just went to a play with her last night, as a matter of fact.
And that's important that you have a sponsor, and I always make sure that it's important that I mentioned that to people because my sponsor was so instrumental.
Absolutely. There are times I can think back on times where I wish I had listened to my sponsor more. I can't think of a single time I had done something and wished I had listened to my sponsor less. So that's a good thing.
It means you found the right sponsor, I think.
Yeah, my sponsor, I was fortunate. She was in AA for a long time, and then she was my ACA sponsor, and so she still sponsored me like an AA sponsor would have, a little bit more strict and a little less touchy-feely than some ACA sponsor. We started working the 12 steps, as well as I was doing what's called the Yellow Book Workbook group in my with some what we call fellow travelers in ACA. So ACA is unique in the sense that because adult children of alcoholics have certain common traits, such as fear of authority figures. Sometimes that sponsorship model, that didactic or whatever, that teacher-pupil dynamic is enough to keep an ACA-er from coming back to another meeting.
It can trigger.
It can really trigger, yeah. So at first, we start off with what's called the fellow traveler model, which is kind of like side-by-side sponsorship until you're nurtured enough that you maybe need a little more structure. And at first, it might look like just kind of talking about stuff. But then if your sponsor's not getting you into the 12 steps, opening up that book with you, the red book is what we have in ACA, then you're doing yourself a disservice by not asking, hey, can we get into this red book now? And then the yellow book is a workbook group. You and a group of anywhere between 8 and 12 other people will go through. And the yellow book and the red book are very similar, except that they obviously have questions and inventory sheets and 8-step amends lists. And, you know, it's very, I mean, God bless AA, you know, because they made it all.
They provided the footprint. They provided the instruction manual that was able to be adapted.
Absolutely.
And so you're working through the 12 steps much like you would in AA then, yes, in ACA.
Yep. Yep. And, you know, we got to the end of the 12 step. Well, got to the sixth step. And I remember feeling like, whoa, I was like somebody who was ice skating with a partner. And then all of a sudden the partner flung me off and said, go hook up with another partner. Cause my sponsor at step six assigned me to go to her other sponsees and have coffee, ask them, how did they do step six? How did they do step seven? So that you don't get stuck dependent upon your sponsor, you know? And so that also forces you out of your little like cozy sponsee nest.
Absolutely.
And so she wouldn't go on to the next step with me until I had met with three other sponsees, had coffee, you know, and I couldn't meet with them all at the same time. I actually had to make that awkward phone call three times. And these were women that I had already known from the meeting now going on 6-8 months because, you know, we worked a step a month and it was a great practice. And we got to eighth step and, you know, my fifth step took like 6 hours with her at her house one day. The eighth step took a little less, just kind of making that list and checking it twice kind of thing. And then once I got
Did you use your fourth step in order to create your eighth step?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, in ACA, the first person, and you know, I've not worked the steps through through AA yet. I plan on it, but in ACA, the first person on your eighth step amends list is always yourself, for having allowed yourself to hold on to the resentment as long as you have, and all of the damage that you've caused yourself in your life from holding on to resentments for that long.
And I think that, you know, when you hear that in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous quite a bit, and there's two different schools, people that believe you should and people that believe you shouldn't. Typically, older school believes you shouldn't.
Sure.
And newer school believes you should. I think, by and large, based on 4 years of recovery, the majority of folks within AA, NA, believe it's good and right to have yourself on that list.
Right. Yeah. It's what's the old thing? Nobody died from a snake bite, right? It's the venom. And so, you know, identifying what the venom is and what's your anti-venom is huge. So by taking your fourth step inventory and rolling it into your eighth step amends list, you really, in that time between there, you really get to see how these things are still showing up in your life today. The perfectionism that stops you from meeting deadlines, for instance, you know, which rolls into procrastination. Codependency that stops you from engaging in fellowship because, you know, you've got to be at home or at work all the time. You know, you just really, the character defects list, judgmentalness and mystical thinking or false beliefs. Like, I mean, the character defects in ACA, they're pretty, I don't know, are they pretty much the same as in AA?
They are yeah. The same things? And I think in AA, for us anyway, let me speak for me. It came down to how I did or did not show up in life.
Right. Right.
Right. And fear really at the center of that.
Mm-hmm. There's only two things, right? Fear and love. That's all there
Bingo.
Is. Just those two. You know, though we discourage black and white thinking and the dualities in life, I can say that you could almost sum any emotion into those two categories. It's like in restaurant cooking, there's mother sauces. There's the five mother sauces from which all other sauces derive. In life, I think there's fear and there's love.
Fear and there's love. And in to the extent that I was either afraid of not getting something that I thought I needed, mm-hmm. mostly thought I needed.
Right.
Not just wanted, but needed.
Right.
My actions that hurt other people were derived out of thinking I needed something in order to be okay.
Right. And that peace finds itself in between the grasping and the aversion, the needing and the having. It's that okay.
What a great release to realize that I, you know, yes, I hurt people and I needed to make those amends. And I needed to identify the ways in which I hurt people. But I hurt them because I thought I was getting... it was in pursuit of something I desperately was convinced I needed for survival, that I needed it to be okay.
Right.
I needed this love from this person. I needed this security from this person. I needed this money.
Right.
Because without it, I'm not okay. Yeah. I'm afraid I won't be okay without it. And that's what it really came down to me in the fourth and fifth step, is a series of behavior patterns that were designed to make me feel okay.
Well, you know, and that okay is what leads to, you know, in your whatever your life statement was up until recovery. And mine was, I'm not enough. Yours was, I'm not okay.
I'm not okay.
Some people's are, I'm not safe. Some people's are, I'm not loved. I'm not lovable. I'm not loving. Like, you know, it's whatever you're, you know, I believe that step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, all of it, really, you find out what was your thinking up until you walked in the doors.
And what are the behavior patterns that supported that?
Right. If your life statement is, I'm not enough, then you're going to be constantly going out seeking more of whatever that is. And again, too, children of alcoholics have an addiction to excitation. So that's going to look like more chaos. I'm not enough. Right. I'm not enough chaos today. You know? When has anybody ever thought that
more,
in recovery?
More.
More travel, more friends, more boyfriends, more alcohol, more money, more prestige, more promotion.
Responsibility.
More responsibility. Yeah. And if
I'll take that extra responsibility and that title and no more pay. Yes.
Right. Exactly. And if your life statement was, I'm not okay, then you probably go around finding things that are going to soothe you.
Bingo. Right?
More of things that are going to soothe you.
That are going to make me feel okay again.
Right.
And so then it was a process of then in 6 and 7, those character defects that arose out of 4 and 5, then, you know, I had this idea that steps 6 and 7 were, try really hard as you can, Charlie, on your very own self to remove those character defects without any extra help from anybody. Right. That's what I thought they said. Right. That's how that filter came in, you know?
Yep.
And it wasn't about that, right? It was about releasing those and then working on the opposite.
Yeah.
Right. So if I have a character defect that says that I need to control situations, mm-hmm. right? I can't just try really hard not to control. It doesn't work for me. What does work for me is work on the opposite, which is acceptance of people, places, and things the way they are. Right.
Absolutely. You know, of course. If you've ever seen the film Apollo 13, right? Dudes are up there in the space thing and the people down on the ground get dumped on a table, a bunch of stuff. And they're like, okay, we've got to make this stuff, this vacuum hose and this scotch tape and this filter. We've got to make this a thing that's going to allow oxygenation to the astronauts that are in this space shuttle, right? Or else they're going to die. And if we look at recovery the same way, if we dump out all of the tools that we have onto a table to address the, this person is not okay today, like you mentioned acceptance, and that's one of them, right? Letting go is another, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, reaching out, asking and accepting help is another. Like there's so many tools at our disposal in recovery. And before there was one on the table and that was it. You can't save astronauts with one tool.
I like that. I like that a lot. Tell me a little bit about what life is like today in recovery.
Man,
now you're a chef, so you deal with a lot of, you know, I'm assuming when you got sober and you entered recovery, Melinda, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm assuming that the restaurant industry didn't all of a sudden become super, super functional and healthy.
No. Well, to be 100% transparent, I'm no longer in the restaurant industry. My last job ended in the restaurant industry on March 31st of 2017. I almost consider that a clean date in my book because, you know, it was that day that I recognized I was no longer living in a way that was sustainable. I was still working overnights from like 3 a.m. till sometimes 3 in the afternoon. I was doing baking at a local restaurant and I was going to school in the mornings and trying to date, you know, doing the online dating thing. And so, I mean, I was running myself to the nub very much like I was when I was using substances. And in fact, I think I was still using substances up until then. My very last drink of alcohol I've ever had was on January 19th of 2018.
Melinda's story got cut a bit short due to a technical snafu. So I'll do my level best to encapsulate the what it's like now for you all with Melinda. Melinda is living a life beyond her wildest dreams, due in large measure to the work she has and continues to put into recovery. No longer an active chef, Melinda is motivated to bring recovery and wellness to the restaurant industry in a meaningful and tangible way. The restaurant industry is marred by an exceptionally high substance abuse rate, which is exacerbated by employees who generally earn a low wage and don't have the flexibility to take time off of work to address these issues. Make no mistake, I believe, with every fiber of my being, that Melinda is destined by a power greater than ourselves to speak to people about her recovery journey. And when she finds that voice and hones her message, it will be quite powerful. It will carry the power to bring real change in people's lives. If you want to reach out to Melinda, please email us at share@wayoutcast.com. That's share@wayoutcast.com. And I'll be sure to get the message to Melinda. Thank you so much, Melinda, for sharing your story with all of us. Thank you for being a part of The Way Out. We appreciate your ears. We're sharing powerful recovery stories and recovery power topics every week, so keep listening up. If you would like to reach out to the show, you can visit us on the web at wayoutcast.com. That's wayoutcast, all one word, .com. There you can subscribe to the Way Out podcast on all of the major podcast aggregators, such as iTunes, CastBox, Stitcher, TuneIn, Podbean, Overcast, and more. Or simply drop your hosts a friendly email at share@wayoutcast.com. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on the show, contact us at share@wayoutcast.com. See you next time, and remember, if you don't change, your sobriety date will.